KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.5.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about.
60 white South African Afrikaners have arrived in the U.S. after being granted refugee status, even as the U.S. suspends refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. We'll go to South Africa to speak with an Afrikaner journalism professor whose new piece is headlined Trump's Fake Refugees. And we'll speak with a black South African political analyst about race, power, and the politics of distraction. Then Palestinians mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes as Israel also carried out massacres upon its founding. Many Palestinians say they face a second Nakba today.
Despite all of the circumstances, we are maintaining our land and rooted here. Our right of return will never be forgotten, and Palestine will always be Palestine.
We'll speak with a Cornell University professor, lead author of a major new report released by U.S. academics called Apartheid in Israel, that concludes Israel's treatment of Palestinians meets the legal threshold of apartheid. And as Israel's brutal assault continues, we'll also look at a Starvation in Gaza report with Alex DeWall, author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israeli strikes have killed over 100 people in the past day, the majority of them children and women, as Palestinians grow increasingly desperate in their daily struggle for survival more than 10 weeks after Israel cut off all imports of humanitarian aid, including food and medicine. Thousands were seen fleeing Gaza City after the Israeli military once again issued forced relocation orders, among them sick and wounded patients at Al-Shifa Hospital who were left to fend for themselves in Gaza streets.
My daughter was admitted to the hospital as a result of the siege, starvation, and malnutrition. We do not know where to go with the patients. We are fleeing from one death to another. We are dying slowly. Everything we have is over. We are dying 1,000 times every day. Until when will this let down? Until when is this siege? Until when is this weakness in our nation?
Israel's brutal assault on Gaza continued as Palestinians commemorated the 77th anniversary of Nakba, which is Arabic for catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes by Israel's founders. This is a Palestinian resident of Ramallah who joined Nakba Day marches in the occupied West Bank.
Despite all of the circumstances, we are maintaining our land and rooted here. Our right of return will never be forgotten, and Palestine will always be Palestine.
Human Rights Watch is condemning Israel's plan to demolish Gaza's remaining civilian infrastructure while concentrating the Palestinian population into a tiny area. HRW said such actions would, quote, amount to an abhorrent escalation of Israel's ongoing crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and acts of genocide, unquote. Adding, quote, Israel's blockade has transcended military tactics to become a tool of extermination, unquote. On Wednesday, activists with Taxpayers Against Genocide delivered a complaint to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, D.C., calling on the U.S. to follow its obligations to prevent genocide under the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. Huwaid Araf is lead attorney in the case.
Because when you support genocide, you basically violate every right that's guaranteed in the American Declaration, which the United States is held to. The first and foremost among them is the right to life.
President Donald Trump again called for the U.S. to take over Gaza and turn it into what he called a freedom zone. He made the comments earlier today from Qatar as he continues his tour of the Gulf states. On Wednesday, Sheikh Tamim Al Thani welcomed Trump for an official state visit with a lavish ceremony. During his visit, Trump announced Qatar had agreed to deals with U.S. companies worth close to $250 million, including worth over $240 billion, including a $96 billion deal for Boeing to sell hundreds of jets to Qatar.
From Boeing, that's the largest order of jets in the history of Boeing. That's pretty good. So that's a record, Kelly. Then congratulations to Boeing. Get those planes out there.
The White House says Trump still plans to accept the $400 million luxury jet from Qatar, known as the Flying Palace, to replace Air Force One temporarily, despite bipartisan criticism, including from Senate Majority Leader John Thune and other top Republicans. NBC News reports the cost of converting the plane could take several years at a cost of over $1 billion. Trump is traveling to the United Arab Emirates today for the final leg of his Middle East tour. In Virginia, Georgetown University scholar Barakhan Suri has united with his family following his release on bail from a Texas ICE jail after a federal judge Wednesday ruled his detention violated his rights to free speech and due process. Khansouri's release comes 1 week after Tufts scholar Ramesa Osterk was freed from a Louisiana ICE jail and 2 weeks after Columbia University student Mohsen Madawi was released from ICE custody in Vermont. Federal agents abducted Khansouri outside his home in Virginia in March, separating him from his three children and his wife, a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent. Khansouri is a peace scholar. He recently wrote from behind bars that he'll, quote, leave no avenue unexplored in defying the witch hunt unleashed upon me and others who believe in freedom for Palestinians, he said. The U.S. Supreme Court's hearing arguments today on a case stemming from Trump's plan to end birthright citizenship. The Trump administration's challenging the power of federal courts to rule against Trump's executive order and to impose nationwide injunctions. In other news from D.C., Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told House lawmakers she backed the idea of suspending habeas corpus to carry out the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. At the hearing, California Democratic Congressmember Eric Swalwell blasted Noem for refusing to disavow President Trump's use of a photoshopped image of a tattooed hand, which Trump claimed as proof the expelled Maryland father, Kilmer Abrego Garcia, was an MS-13 gang member. This is part of their exchange.
You are one of the chief law enforcement officials in the country. What have you done to investigate whether the president misrepresented the reason that that person has been detained?
Sir,
have you done anything to try and figure out whether that was doctored or not?
The mission of the Department of Homeland Security is to secure our nation and to make sure that we're out there going after those that are the worst of the worst, the criminals, the bad actors. Abrego Garcia.
So the answer is you've done nothing to correct the president.
In related news, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard has fired two senior officials who oversaw the National Intelligence Council's report contradicting Trump's rationale for invoking the Alien Enemies Act to expel alleged members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua without due process. In other immigration news, the Trump administration said it's charging Harvard scientist Xenia Petrova with smuggling for failing to declare frog samples while she was traveling. Petrova was detained in February and transferred to an ICE jail in Louisiana. She faces political persecution if deported back to her home country of Russia over her protests against the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Petrova is a highly skilled scientist whose work could lead to major advances in early cancer detection. A Russian delegation has arrived in Turkey for the first direct peace talks with Ukraine in over 3 years, but the delegation does not include Russia's President Vladimir Putin, nor its foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. Instead, several of Putin's deputies are attending. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Russia's presence decorative as he arrived in Ankara today. Zelensky had challenged Putin to negotiate a face-to-face peace deal. Shortly after Russia's announcement, the White House said President Donald Trump would also skip the peace talks. On Wednesday, officials in Ukraine's northeastern city of Sumy said a Russian missile attack on an industrial site killed at least three civilians. The German charity Sea Watch reports two children, aged 3 and 4, died after a rubber dinghy carrying refugees from Libya to Italy broke down and was stranded in the Mediterranean. The children died of dehydration. One other person drowned in the journey. Another 59 passengers survived. In Libya, rival militias traded fire Wednesday in the capital, Tripoli, just hours after a truce had been called following the worst fighting in the area for years. The clashes broke out Monday following the killing of the leader of a powerful armed group that's been accused of major human rights abuses in Libya's migrant detention facilities. At least 6 people were killed. Libya's ruled by 2 main authorities, while armed groups vie for control over Libya's natural resources. A UN-recognized government in Tripoli is led by Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dibba, while a rival administration in the east of the country is controlled by Khalifa Haftar and his Libyan National Army. Here in New York, the federal sex trafficking and racketeering trial for 90s hip-hop star business mogul Sean Diddy Combs is underway. On Wednesday, his ex-partner, Cassie Ventura, detailed Diddy's intense physical and sexual abuse during their relationship, including how he forced her to participate in hundreds of drug-fueled sex parties he called freak-offs. Ventura also told the court Diddy raped her after their relationship ended. Jurors were shown a video of Diddy beating and kicking Ventura, dragging her on the floor of a Los Angeles hotel outside an elevator in 2016. Sean Diddy Combs is accused by multiple women of sexual assault, trafficking, and exploitation over decades. He was arrested in September. If convicted, he faces a possible life sentence. Congressional Democrats grilled Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in back-to-back hearings in the House and Senate Wednesday. Kennedy defended major cuts to HHS as part of the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle federal agencies, insisting key programs would still operate without offering any concrete plans. He was also questioned about his response to the growing U.S. measles outbreak and his vaccine skepticism. This is an exchange with Congressmember Mark Pocan.
If you had a child today, would you vaccinate that child for measles?
For measles? Probably for measles. What I would say is my opinions about vaccines are irrelevant. I have directed Jay Bhattacharya.
Sure. No, like I said, I don't want to.
So that everybody can make that decision. But I don't want to measles. Seem like I'm being evasive.
Yeah.
But I don't think people should be taking advice, medical advice, right, from me.
Peace activists disrupted Kennedy's Senate hearing, leading to their forced removal and the arrest of 7 protesters, among them Ben & Jerry's co-founder, Ben Cohen.
Congress will be arrested. Poor kids in Gaza by buying bombs and pays for it by kicking kids off Medicaid in the U.S.
RFK Jr. is ordering the FDA to review regulations around the highly prescribed abortion pill, mifepristone, citing a new study that experts have called fatally flawed and junk science. The ACLU said Kennedy's trying to, quote, make it harder for people to get medication abortions based on propaganda pushed out by a Project 2025 sponsor, unquote, while leaving the final decision on the matter to Trump. The ACLU added, quote, we should all be scared if our access to safe FDA-approved medications turns on President Trump's gut instinct rather than credible scientific evidence, unquote. In another blow for abortion rights, South Carolina Supreme Court has upheld the state's 6-week abortion ban, which outlaws nearly all abortions. and House Republicans have successfully pushed through proposals that would slash Medicaid and food stamps as part of Trump's budget, making his 2017 tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans permanent by taking away essential services for the rest of the country. The measure could leave more than 8.6 million people without health care over the next decade. Some Senate Republicans have voiced concerns over the bill, namely that it doesn't include steep enough spending cuts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says he will meet with President Trump at the White House next week after a group of some 59 Afrikaners arrived in the United States Monday after being granted refugee status. Afrikaners are the white South Africans who ruled the country during apartheid. This comes as the Trump administration has suspended refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. Speaking Monday, Trump claimed white South Africans face racial discrimination, even though the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland decades after the end of apartheid rule. Trump said he's allowing them to come to the United States to escape, quote, genocide.
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about, but it's a terrible thing that's taking place, and farmers are being killed. They happen to be white. But whether they're white or black makes no difference to me. But white farmers are being brutally killed and their land is being confiscated in South Africa.
On Monday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa refuted Trump's claims that white people are being persecuted in his country, calling it, quote, a completely false narrative. On Tuesday, Ramaphosa recounted a conversation he'd had with Trump about the situation in his country.
I had a conversation with President Trump on the phone, and he said, what's happening down there? And I said, President, what you've been told by those people who are opposed to transformation back home in South Africa is not true. And I added to him, I said, we were well taught by Nelson Mandela and other iconic leaders like Oliver Tambo on how to continue to build a united nation out of the diverse groupings that we have in South Africa. We're the only country on the continent where the colonizers came to stay, and we have never driven them out of our country. So they are staying, and they're making great progress. It's a fringe grouping that does not have a lot of support, that is anti-transformation and anti-change, that would actually prefer to see South Africa going back to apartheid type of policies.
This comes as South African-born Trump advisor and multi-billionaire Elon Musk has also accused South Africa's government of promoting what he calls white genocide. Musk's grandfather moved his family to South Africa after embracing the country's apartheid system.
On Wednesday, Musk's artificial intelligence chatbot, Grok, became a trending topic on X when people tried to use it to answer questions and check facts. And the chatbot added the topic of white genocide in South Africa to its responses, telling users it was, quote, instructed by my creators to accept the genocide, quote, as real and racially motivated, no matter what the question was. For more, we're joined in Cape Town, South Africa, by two guests. Herman Wasserman is with us, professor of journalism, director of the Center for Information Integrity in Africa at Stellenbosch University. His new piece for the website Africa is a Country is headlined Trump's Fake Refugees. Wasserman himself is a white South African, an Afrikaner. And Andile Zulu is a political analyst with the Alternative Information and Development Center. His new piece for the website Africa is a Country is titled Race, Power, and the Politics of Distraction. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Herman Wasserman, let's begin with you. You are a white South African and you are an Afrikaner. If you can explain, first of all, to the world what exactly that means and what you thought when you heard President Trump charge white genocide in South Africa.
Well, I would say that my first response was one of incredulity, and later met with, you know, I think with disgust even, and just rejection of this notion of a white genocide or whites being persecuted. And I think that view is shared by many others, white South Africans, and certainly the majority of South Africans in the country.
Well, Andile Zulu, if you could also respond to this, these claims of a white genocide in South Africa and Trump bringing over these 59 Afrikaners to the U.S., and talk about this in the context of this the new law that replaces the 1975 Expropriation Act in South Africa, and explain why that's been so controversial and what it entails.
Well, this accusation of white genocide emanating from the White House is a conspiracy theory and a myth that has been floating around echo chambers of right-wing populists and white nationalists for many decades now, particularly within the online space. And it essentially holds the accusation that white South Africans, in particular Afrikaans South Africans, are victims of deliberate, direct, state-sanctioned violence. And anyone who lives in this country, who's awake to the reality of this country, the inequality, the poverty, the unemployment that most Black South Africans have to endure, and including Indian and colored South Africans as well, knows that it's patently untrue. And the truth, however, is irrelevant to those who are perpetuating this myth. What matters is that it's a means through which you can mobilize anxiety, mobilize fear, and mobilize frustration from a segment, I think a relatively small segment of the population that is dissatisfied with the post-apartheid democracy and the loss of their political elevated status. It's a way in which you can mobilize fears here in South Africa and then appeal to a base within the MAGA movement in the US as well to portray the Donald Trump presidency as essentially being a crusader to defend white civilization, both in the USA and here. And this all began initially with the signing by the president, Ramaphosa, of the Expropriation Act, which in itself is not that much of a radical or progressive policy. It's a very procedural piece of legislation, which essentially changes the criteria through which government can expropriate private property for the public good and for the public use, on the basis of finding just and equitable compensation. And in fact, most legal experts have said that the instances in which you'll arrive at nil compensation, at no compensation, would be quite rare, actually. So this legislation isn't an assault on white livelihoods. It isn't even an attack on the dominance of private property relations in post-apartheid. But for Elon Musk and for Donald Trump, it's doing what right-wing populism, what racial ideologies always function to do, which is to stoke fear, conflict, and division in order to be able to protect the exploitative and unequal relations under South Africa's neoliberal capitalism, and I think under the neoliberal order that we have more broadly.
And Andile, I mean, I just want to add these a couple of things that I wanted to say earlier, which is to clarify for audiences who aren't as aware of South Africa's history. It was a 1913 law that gave over 90% of South Africa's land to whites. Today, they are some 7% of the population are white South Africans, but they still own about half, 50% of the country's land. Afrikaners, who constitute the majority of the white population, are among, of course, the most successful and richest in South Africa. So if you could explain, Andile, how has this news, Trump's statement, the fact that these 59 people have now arrived in the U.S., how has that been received in South Africa, this news?
I think it's been a mixture of frustration and bewilderment and just real confusion as to what is the basis of the idea that white South Africans, in particular Afrikaners, are being persecuted. And as you said, South Africa in the post-apartheid, the past 30 years of democracy that we have, comes out of a history of a white supremacist regime which not only dispossessed people of color of their land, but also then set up a rigorous economic system of exploitation to ensure the underdevelopment of Black people, Indians and coloreds included, to be able to amass economic and political power. Now, if you just look, for example, at the statistics that we have on the racial manifestations of inequality in this country, it's quite clear that this myth of white genocide and of white persecution has no basis in reality. For example, the unemployment rate amongst white South Africans sits at 7.9% as compared to 36.9% for Black South Africans. The poverty rate for white South Africans sits at 1% as compared to 64% for South Africans. And in fact, the people who are the victims of violence by and large due to organized crime and due to the symptoms of societal dysfunction are largely young Black men and young Black women. If you are a young Black person in the place where I live, in Cape Town, and you live in a township in a rural area, you are 16 times more likely to be a victim of homicide as compared to a white South African. But however, it's just important to clarify that white South Africans, of course, because we are all living in a country that has many issues and many crises, are still, of course, victims of violent crime, of state dysfunction, of economic anxiety and of financial precarity, but they are not victims of those things, but because they are white. Those issues are a symptom of a larger dysfunction due to an incapacitated state run by kleptocrats trying to enforce neoliberalism on an increasingly dysfunctional economy. So it's quite important to say that the myth of white genocide has no basis in reality. However, South Africa is facing crises, the three crises of mass unemployment, of inequality, and of poverty. And those results from the choices, the bad policy choices that the ANC has made since 1996, which is essentially an abiding commitment to neoliberal policy, the kinds of policies which are causing the crises that we see in the United States and in many parts of the world as well.
I wanted to go back to Professor Herman Wasserman. Here in the United States, powerful group of men around Trump, known often as the PayPal Mafia, co-founders and members of PayPal, extend to apartheid South Africa. Its members, Elon Musk, co-founder of PayPal, with Peter Thiel, along with David Sachs and Roelof Botha. So you have this situation where most refugees in the world are not allowed into the United States right now, where refugees are being thrown out of the United States. But you have this group on Monday of 59 white South African Afrikaners arriving in the United States after being granted refugee status. Can you talk about the small group around Trump and what they mean for Trump's worldview right now and what it means that these refugees are brought here? Did it get much attention in South Africa? I shouldn't say refugees, but these white South African Afrikaners.
Yes, I think many South African media outlets refer to these refugees in inverted commas because I think that is the general understanding that they are not really refugees. As you have pointed out, it flies in the face of the really dire and tragic circumstances that many people around the world live under and that would be much more eligible for refugee status. In fact, as Andile has pointed out, this whole refugee status is based on disinformation. It's based on a disinformation campaign. And so some of it, it's hard, of course, to pinpoint exactly what happened first. And one could argue that some of these white former South Africans around Donald Trump would have had his ear and would have maybe helped him tapped into this sort of narrative of white persecution. They also represent to him maybe white South Africans who have left the country and have sought their fortunes elsewhere. And, you know, but I think what is also important to recognize is that this has also been the result of a concerted effort by some Afrikaner lobby groups over many years to fan that idea that South African, white South Africans, especially Afrikaners, are being persecuted. There have been a consistent campaign by the Afrikaner rights group AfriForum who have been pushing that narrative for many years. They have lobbied Washington. They have met Republican officials. They've appeared on conservative media outlets like the Tucker Carlson Show. They've extended their road shows to conservative think tanks and conferences in Europe, like CPAC in Hungary. And in all these places, they painted a dire picture of South Africa, where white farmers are supposedly under constant attack, where they're singled out for violence. They are on the verge of losing their land, that they are unfairly being targeted by a corrupt and totalitarian government which discriminates against them in what they would call a type of reverse apartheid. And all of this was very deftly wrapped up in a communication strategy that then eventually found sympathetic ears among U.S. conservatives. And I think with these men around, white former South Africans around Trump, which would have amplified that to him. And now with this so-called refugee campaign, their communication campaign over these many years, their lobbying has finally paid off. I think in terms of the South African media, there have been a range of responses, but I think by and large, people recognize that this has no basis in reality. As Andile said, this is based on a disinformation campaign. You know, some of the conservative elements in the society might find that now somebody has listened to their complaints and taken that seriously. But, you know, anybody who really has their basis in factual reality would know that this is a ruse, that this is a disinformation campaign, and that actually these little group of so-called refugees are pawns in a much larger political campaign, a campaign both domestically in the U.S., where Trump is using them as, you know, as pawns, as props in a campaign that purports to promote whiteness and whiteness under threat, and also geopolitically in his executive order, which granted this refugee status to Afrikaners. It was juxtaposed very closely with criticism of South Africa for taking Israel to the ICJ. So this can clearly also be seen as a message to South Africa to punish them for their stance on Israel and Israel's war on Gaza and the U.S.'s involvement and support of that war. So I think one has to understand that this is, although this group of Afrikaners might be the tokens, might be the people propped up in front of the cameras in this media event, that they are actually pawns and props in a much larger domestic and geopolitical campaign for Trump, and also domestically in South Africa for a group of Afrikaners who actually do not have any intention to leave. AfriForum and these groups said that they do not want to leave. In other words, this is really a power play for them domestically as well, to force the South African government to take them their complaints more seriously, to take their claims to privilege more seriously. So it is not really about that group of 49 mm-hmm. or however many refugees.
And of course, the U.S. threw out the South African ambassador to the United States as well, as President Trump goes after universities that talk about structural and historical racism in the United States. Herman Wasserman, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of journalism, director of the Center for Information Integrity in Africa at Stellenbosch University. His new piece, we'll link to, in Africa as a Country, is headlined Trump's Fake Refugees. Professor Wasserman, himself an Afrikaner, a white South African, and Andile Zulu, political analyst with the Alternative Information and Development Center. His new piece for the website is Race, Power, and the Politics of Distraction. We'll link to that as well. Both of them joining us from Cape Town, South Africa. Next up, as Palestinians mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, Israel's brutal assault continues. We'll speak with a Cornell University professor, lead author of a report released by U.S. academics concluding Israel's treatment of Palestinians meets the legal threshold of apartheid. Back in 30 seconds.
Pictures. to the morning, taste and devour. We rise early, pace up the hour. Streets is bustling, hustling, they harder. You can't have the sweet with no sour. Spices, herbs, the sweet scent of flower. She came out precisely the hour. Clouds disappear, the sun shows the power. No chance of a probable shower. I fell in love with my neighbor's daughter. I wanted to protect and support her. Never mind, I'm just 12 and a quarter. I had dreams beyond our border. Is it true when they say all you need is just love? Is it true? What about those who have loved?
Fatima by Kanan, the Canadian-Somali musician in our Democracy Now! Studio years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Today, Palestinians mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, the mass expulsion of Palestinians in 1948 when Israel was created. Many Palestinians say they face a second Nakba today in both Gaza and in the occupied West Bank, where Palestinians marched in Ramallah to commemorate Nakba Day.
Despite all of the circumstances, we are maintaining our land and rooted here. Our right of return will never be forgotten, and Palestine will always be Palestine.
This comes as Democratic Congressmember Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, has introduced a resolution to commemorate Nakba Day with support from a growing number of co-sponsors, including Congressmembers Andre Carson, Summer Lee, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Delia Ramirez, Latifa Simon, and Bonnie Watson-Coleman. This is Congressmember Tlaib.
Hello, it's Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. And this Thursday, May 15th, marks the 77th year of Government of Israel's ongoing Nakba against the Palestinian people. We all know that in 1948, the Government of Israel destroyed hundreds of Palestinian villages, towns, and cities, and ethnically cleansed hundreds of thousands of Palestinians.
For more, we turn to a major new report released today by U.S. academics that analyzes Israel's actions in Gaza under the legal framework of the crime of apartheid, citing dozens of experts, human rights organizations, and judicial decisions. It concludes Israel's treatment of Palestinians, quote, includes mass killing, arbitrary detention, torture, and the imposition of a legal regime that provides far less due process than that provided to Israelis living in the same territory meets the legal threshold of apartheid, unquote. We're joined now by one of the report's principal authors, Sandra Babcock, director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Cornell Law School, where she is clinical professor and is joining us from now. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Babcock. If you can talk about the significance of today, the day you're releasing this report, and your major findings.
Thank you, Amy. It's so nice to be back on the show. We are releasing this report that concludes that Israel has committed and is committing the crime of apartheid, which is a crime against humanity, on Nakba Day, because Palestinians are now living through the most brutal phase of the decades-long occupation of their territory that the International Court of Justice has recognized is an illegal occupation. Our report confirms that there is now a broad international consensus that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid. We're not the first people to say this, but we are the first group of academics to analyze over 25 reports and judicial opinions against the backdrop of what is now happening in Gaza. And our conclusions are that Israel is not only isolating Palestinians into segregated enclaves in the West Bank, that it is subjecting them to a different legal regime than their Jewish settler neighbors, that it is not only subjecting them to arbitrary detention, torture, and killings, but it is doing this against a backdrop of policies that are designed to ensure the perpetual racial subordination of the Palestinian people.
Well, in Professor Babcock, in last year, in 2024, you co-authored a report which found that Israel's actions meet the international definition of genocide. So if you could elaborate on the links that you see between Israel's complicity in genocide and the fact that you found that it is an apartheid state.
You know, I think there are important links between the two crimes. These are both crimes. They are both crimes that are recognized under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. And both, what they have in common is a treatment of a group that is motivated in part by racism. In the International Court of Justice has found that Palestinians are a distinct national, ethnic, or racial group that is appropriately the subject of the crime of genocide. And what we found is that Israeli leaders have, for decades now, and this is leaders at the top echelons, the prime minister, the former defense minister, have made comments about Palestinians that evoke age-old racist tropes, comparing Palestinians to animals, dehumanizing them in a way that is very familiar to your previous guests who were speaking about apartheid in South Africa. What I was really struck by in listening to the South Africans that you just had on the show is when they described the features of apartheid South Africa, if you took out the word South Africa and you replaced it with Israel, that would perfectly describe the policies and laws that Israel has in place today. We don't often think of them as apartheid because our thinking of apartheid is rooted in our perceptions of how white South Africans treated black South Africans. But in fact, what is happening in Israel today is reflective of exactly that same treatment that we saw in South Africa.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Babcock, about the significance of you, along with dozens of other senior professors, human rights lawyers, taking part in this report. You're speaking to us from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Talk about that as protests continue across the country. Students who participated in encampments are arrested or put in ICE jails. Some judges have ordered those people released.
You know, Amy, it is a very tough time to be issuing a report that is critical of Israel. It has never been easy to criticize Israel. But this is what we do. We are human rights defenders. We are human rights lawyers. We are human rights professors. And if we can't call out genocide and apartheid when we see it, we can't call ourselves human rights defenders. There is a double standard when it comes to Israel. When we criticize Israel, however, it is really important to recognize we are criticizing a state. We are criticizing a government. We are not criticizing its people. This is what we do. We call out human rights abuses and government repression where we see it. And those of us who have authored this report have been involved in human rights work in every single continent. And we do not make an exception when it comes to Israel. What universities have done is instead of protecting students, faculty, and staff who are standing up and taking a very principled stance and a risky stance to protest Israel's policies of genocide and apartheid, they are penalizing those students. They are subjecting them to disciplinary sanctions for peaceful protests. They are criminalizing them and jeopardizing their futures when, under international human rights law, which protects the right of people who are protesting against human rights violations anywhere in the world to their rights to freedom of opinion, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly. Instead of doing that, the university is criminalizing them. Instead of and I'm talking about universities in general. Mind you, I am not speaking on behalf of Cornell University. I'm speaking in my capacity as a professor who has witnessed the criminalization and disciplinary sanctions that are being imposed on students across the country. And that is wrong, and it needs to stop. Students are doing the right thing. They are standing in the line of fire. They are standing up for people whose rights are being subjected to the most horrific repression, who are being slaughtered every day, who are being starved. This is what we should all be doing. We cannot silence ourselves, and we especially cannot silence ourselves when people are trying to censor what we say.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Sandra Babcock, for being with us, clinical professor at Cornell Law School, director of the International Human Rights Clinic, co-author of the newly released report, Apartheid in Israel, an analysis of Israel's laws and policies and the responsibilities of U.S. academic and other institutions. She co-wrote a new op-ed in The Guardian today headlined, "We Are Human Rights Lawyers. Our new report is clear. Israel perpetrates apartheid." Among those who co-authored that report are Professor Susan Akram, clinical professor and director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University School of Law. Thomas Becker, legal and policy director at the University Network for Human Rights, teaches human rights at Columbia Law School. And James Cavallaro, executive director of the University Network for Human Rights, visiting professor at the Yale Jackson School of Global Affairs. When we come back, as Israel's brutal assault continues, we look at starvation in Gaza with Alex Duvall. Stay with us. On the Mountain, performed by Natalie Coleman and Nora Brown in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show in Gaza, where Israel's brutal assault continues as Palestinians are commemorating the 77th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were violently expelled from their homes by Israel's founders. Officials in Gaza say Israeli strikes have killed over 100 people over the past day, the majority of them children and women. Earlier today at a state dinner in Qatar, President Trump said he wants the U.S. to take Gaza and turn it into a freedom zone.
Well, we're working very hard on Gaza, and Gaza has been a territory of death and destruction. United States get involved and make it just a freedom zone, have a real freedom zone.
A freedom zone. This comes amidst mounting warnings of starvation in Gaza, which is the headline of our next guest's new piece in the London Review of Books. Alex Duvall, executive director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the efforts of so many at Tufts and also outside of Tufts to have Rumeysa released, the Turkish student who was a Fulbright scholar and was taken by masked ICE agents on the streets of Somerville, Rumeysa Ozturk, now out of an ICE jail. Alex, if you can start off by laying out what you found in your new piece for the London Review of Books, Starvation in Gaza.
So just a couple of days ago, the United Nations
integrated food security phase classification, which is a real mouthful. It's a system, it's a collaboration of different humanitarian agencies, and they undertook a survey. It's the fifth such survey since the beginning of the war in the most recent war in Gaza, some 19 months ago. They undertook a survey of food security and malnutrition. And what they found was, yet again, that the majority of people in Gaza are facing emergency or catastrophic levels of food insecurity, and levels of malnutrition are rising fast. And this is directly related to the total blockade imposed upon the Gaza Strip at the beginning of March. And normally, in situations of famine, there are many complex factors that work in between the level of food availability and children getting hungry and beginning to die in large numbers. In the case of Gaza, it's actually, sadly, a lot more straightforward. There's really the only food that is available is that that is permitted to enter by Israel. And those food stocks are running out. Rations are getting low, and the poorest and most vulnerable are beginning to starve and die.
Well, you write in your piece, Alex Deval, that, quote, Gaza is an anomaly, a laboratory in which we will discover how much nutritional stress a population can withstand before succumbing en masse. So if you could elaborate on that and whether that is indeed the conclusion that was reached in the IPC report.
So a normal, healthy adult will last somewhere between 60 and 80 days deprived of all nutrition. Now, we haven't got to that stage, but children perish much more quickly, and there are a significant numbers of children who need specialized feeding, need food that cannot be readily prepared with just the food that is available, with the lack of clean water, the lack of electricity supplies. So we are seeing the most vulnerable already succumbing. And there are two scenarios that were laid out in this report. One is a situation in which the status quo continues. The level of blockade and the level of destruction continue unimpeded, in which case mass starvation, famine is inevitable. It is a question of weeks before that unfolds. The second scenario is if the Israeli-US plan for setting up an alternative humanitarian system comes into play. Now, the background to this is that Israel wants to debar the UNRWA and the United Nations and other international humanitarian organizations from being present on the ground in Gaza, and to put humanitarian provision in the hands of a new system, a new method, a new scheme, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And not many details are available about this, but what is known is that the plan is to have just four distribution centers in a small part of Gaza, supplying at most 60% of the population with minimum rations. And the food would be brought and distributed by members of this new foundation, including U.S. private military contractors, protected by the IDF. And it would simply be those rations and basic hygiene and medical kits. There would be no reconstruction of infrastructure, no specialized feeding for malnourished children, etc. Now, even if this were to work, the conclusion of the IPC, it doesn't spell it out in quite so many words, but it's pretty clear. The conclusion is mass starvation would still unfold, just somewhat more slowly.
So, Alex, could you also talk about the fact of this concept of yours of surveillance humanitarianism? How does the aid scheme that you've just been talking about that is proposed by the Israelis and backed by the Americans fit into that? How precisely would it work? You've also said the plan is, quote, an individualized version of late colonial counterinsurgency.
back in the 1950s, the British government mounted a anti-communist counterinsurgency in Malaya, and they explicitly called it Operation Starvation. And the idea was that every individual who was in a protected village would and was properly accredited with the authorities would receive enough food. And every item of food was counted going into those protected villages. And outside the protected villages, where the communist guerrillas were able to roam, no food would be available. They would be forced to starve. Now, what we're seeing is a version of this, a much more sophisticated version being being implemented by Israel today. So clearly their intent is that no food should get into the hands of Hamas. And they have details about every individual in Gaza. So the plan, as by inference, is that they would screen every individual and they would put accredited individuals who have no link to Hamas on the distribution list. Those individuals would be notified by text message to come to pick up the rations that they are allocated at a certain time in a certain place. And their identities would be verified by face recognition and other technologies. And then they would go, they would take those rations. Those rations would presumably be just enough for a few days, perhaps a week, so that they would there would be very little chance of them falling into the hands of anybody else. And then they would have to come back. So it is the welfare, indeed, the survival of every Palestinian family in Gaza would be dependent on a week-to-week basis on this type of surveillance and accreditation system. You can look at it as the counterpart of the surveillance and AI algorithms, the Lavender system that is being used by Israel to identify members of Hamas whom they are targeting for assassination. So they would have a counterpart for feeding the people whom they are prepared to keep alive.
Meanwhile, Alex Duvall, the New York Times is reporting some Israeli officials are privately admitting Gaza is on the brink of starvation and warn of the effects if the blockade is not lifted, since it takes a while, though there are thousands of trucks waiting outside to get in, to increase the humanitarian aid. And you have President Trump today in Qatar talking about is Gaza being a freedom zone controlled by the United States. Your response?
I'm not quite sure what President Trump means by a freedom zone, but I think it is clear across the board with the information that we have, and I have no doubt Israel has pretty much the same information. They may just dispute some of the details, but the overall picture is completely clear that something dramatic is going to have to be done to prevent mass starvation and famine unfolding in the very near future in Gaza. The situation cannot be allowed to get to the brink and then just pull back slightly from the brink, as has been happening when the Israelis opened supply routes and food distribution a year ago, and again with the ceasefire a few months ago. The population simply cannot withstand this type of pressure for really any longer without the utmost catastrophe unfolding.
Well, Alex, you conclude your piece by saying that Israel may, quote, do just enough to keep most Palestinians alive, but whether this prevents the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza as a group is another matter. If you could say what you mean by that, what do you imagine Israel will do?
So the what we see in this process of, if it unfolds, this sort of individually targeted surveillance humanitarianism is keeping individuals and families alive, but dismantling the entire structure of society. Now, clearly, the dismantling of Hamas is the political and military goal of Israel. But if it goes further towards the dismantling of society as a whole, which is one of the things that we often see during famines, it's not just that individualized biological suffering. It is the tearing apart of social bonds, the collective humiliation, the degradation of society. That is the deep trauma, the profound experience of famine. If that is allowed to proceed, then Palestinian society, as it has existed, will be irrevocably changed, torn apart, traumatized. And if Israel knowingly does this, then it will be culpable, not just of the war crime of starvation, but of the destruction of the Palestinian people of Gaza.
Alex Duval, thank you so much for being with us. Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. We'll link to your piece in the London Review of Books headlined Starvation in Gaza. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Director of Technology. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.